some of the locations were, especially in the western part of the state, top one or two coldest months on record.
January was the deep freeze. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a big land crack is causing trouble for the residents of Haines.
The road had opened up about 8 inches vertically and horizontally dropped about 4 inches.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
The U.S. Attorney's Office is recommending a reduced sentence for Arnie Fugelvog. The former fisheries aide to Senator Lisa Murkowski pleaded guilty in August to falsifying records for his sablefish catch in 2005. That year, illegal fishing earned Fugelvog an estimated $100,000. Court documents estimate the total value of Fugelvog's illegal harvests between 2001 and 2006 at $1 million. The terms of Fugelvog's plea agreement included a $50,000 punitive fine and $100,000 community service payment and a public apology in National Fisherman's Magazine. The plea agreement also recommended 10 months in jail, but in a sentencing memorandum released this week, the U.S. Attorney's Office reduced that recommendation to 5 months, citing Fugelvog's cooperation during the investigation. Sentencing is scheduled for 8 a.m. on Tuesday. A Bethel cab driver went missing earlier this week and was later found dead. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
Weather was bitter cold with a 55 below wind chill when 54-year-old Young Chong was last seen alive. It was about 3:30 Tuesday morning, and she was driving a blue Lexus SUV for the cab company Taxi Cab. She never returned home from her shift. Bethel police were notified of her absence at about 11 a.m. and began their search. After failing to find Chong in town, they expanded the search to include the Alaska State Troopers, who have jurisdiction outside of Bethel city limits. Vehicles don't often go missing in Bethel because there are no roads leading out of town. The surrounding area is tundra, which is currently covered in drifted snow. There is a seasonal ice road, however, on the Kuskokwim River, which connects Bethel and surrounding villages, and that appears to be the path that at least Chong's car was on. Her cab was found Wednesday morning in the village of Napakiak, about 10 miles downriver of Bethel. Police say further investigation showed that Chong was found dead, but at this time they will not say whether she was with her car or not. Alaska State Troopers this morning flew in investigators with the Alaska Bureau of Investigation to help with the case. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The Alaska Northern Waters Task Force has given the legislature its findings and recommendations on the effects of climate change in the Arctic and how the state fits into national and international interest in the region. Chairman Reggie Jewell of Kotzebue says the goal was to identify opportunities and challenges for the state.
You know, it's not like Alaska has been absent. I want to make that clear. But it was a way for the legislature, using people from the administration and from the public, to get together and use this task force on getting some information of what are some of the things that we should look at.
Among its recommendations, the task force called for expansion of oil and gas development in the Arctic, as well as for the state and federal governments to improve technology for spill cleanup. It also suggests taking steps to improve the likely increase in marine transportation in the region, and it calls for more fisheries-related research and monitoring. Dillingham Democrat Bryce Edgman said the task force gave the public the opportunity to understand more about what is happening in the Arctic before taking action on individual issues.
We saw firsthand how much is going on internationally around the Arctic, that the Russians have a goal of 2018 and 2019 of transporting LNG from Russia to the market in the Orient. Hopefully the Chinese are building a nuclear icebreaker. You know, maybe a third of the world's hydrocarbon deposits may lie in the Arctic, and that you know, the Bering Strait's choke point, maybe hundreds of mid-sized, large-sized vessels full with hazardous substances. They're going through this very narrow point. You know, that a lot of what we're doing is helping increase the awareness of all the stuff that's happening around us in the world.
Commissioner of Environmental Conservation Larry Hardig pointed to the task force taking a look at long-term issues. He referred to them as things that need to unfold.
If we recognize, you know, where we might be at 10 years from now and we think hard about it, then we can start planning on what we should be doing over that next 10 years to take advantage of that time, so that if and when we get to development, you know, we can do it as safely as possible.
As a mark of ending its assigned task, the group gave the current legislature a resolution establishing an Arctic Policy Commission to build on the findings released today. Links to the task force report are at our website, alaskapublic.org. January 2012 will have a place in the weather record books. National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Brader says locations across the northern half of the state bested or came close to records.
Most of the interior and west coast of Alaska saw very extreme months, in the top five coldest months on record for most of those locations. Some of the locations were, especially in the western part of the state, top one or two coldest months on record.
January was the coldest month ever at Galena. The average temperature at Galena, -32.6, and there were four consecutive days at the end of the month with -60-degree lows, including -65 this past Sunday. Other communities breaking cold records were Nome, McGrath, Tanana, and Bettles. It was the fifth coldest January on record at Fairbanks, with an average temperature of 26.9 below. Brader says the extreme cold was the result of a very persistent pattern in the upper atmosphere or jet stream.
There's ridges and troughs, just like waves on an ocean. And the troughs are where the coldest air mass is. We basically had a large-scale trough sitting over the state for all of January.
February has seen an end to the cold weather pattern. Brader says the jet stream has shifted.
The ridging portion has moved into western Canada and eastern Alaska, so we're starting to see southerly flow between those.
Brader says it's unclear how long the new pattern will hold, but it appears things will stay on the warm side into next week. Bethel also saw weather records broken. January shaped up to be, on average, the coldest in history there. From Bethel, KYUK's Mark Earhart has more.
2012 has started out chilly. Pipes across Bethel are freezing, and people seem to be behaving more like bears this winter, favoring the warmth of their houses rather than braving the elements. Pete Garrison of the National Weather Service in Bethel says no specific day has broken a cold record, but on average, this January is the coldest on the books.
It's not super cold records, but we just never got that warm. Our previous record, 13.2 below, and we're shaping up, we'll be right around 16 plus below zero for this month.
As of the last day of the month, the average was 17.1 below zero. Garrison says the average high this month has been around 11 below, and the average low has been near minus 22. Garrison says he thinks warmer weather is in the future. It will just take a little bit of time.
It's going to take a couple more systems probably through this week before we start to see above zero again.
This January, Bethel only saw 5 days with highs above zero. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Mat-Su Valley writer's first book is a hit.
And until the very last chapters, I wasn't positive what was going to happen. And I don't want to give it away, so I won't say that.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you're an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist award. Visit Rasmussen Foundation on Facebook or on the web at rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
A geologic phenomenon scientists are calling a slow creeping event is threatening homes and vital roadways in the southeast town of Haines, and warm weather in the forecast is only causing more concern. Tara Bicknell has this update from KHNS in Haines, where a large swath of residential land is slowly separating from the mainland.
The ground failure in Haines is shifting at a faster rate and grown to encompass about 5 acres, according to the crews monitoring the horseshoe-shaped piece of land that's been actively creeping toward the ocean since mid-January.
There was a sudden movement last night at about somewhere in the neighborhood of 7:30, 7:15. That was significant enough that it aroused residents there nearby.
Rock Ahrens is the emergency coordinator at the Haines Command Center that formed to monitor the slide zone, which is thought to be moving because of ground saturation and unstable soil.
And there was a noticeable change in the road from when I had left there at 3:30, and the road had opened up about 8 inches vertically and horizontally dropped about 4 inches.
The series of 5 or so cracks in the earth located on the east side of Haines has caused at least one family to evacuate their home and is attracting the attention of weather, engineering, and geology experts throughout the Pacific Northwest. The two roads most affected, Lutac Road and Front Street, are the main access routes to the town's shipping dock, ferry terminal, and a neighborhood of about 50 homes.
If you stop and think, all of our freight comes off of the city dock, of course, and comes into town from that direction. The Yukon and freight into the Anchorage and parts north area, you know, so it's not only vital to us, but internationally, the link that comes across this area that would be wiped out.
The ground failure was first reported on January 16th, and Public Works responded by marking traffic hazards for motorists and monitoring the slope movement. Drilling rigs extracted samples of deep earth from 5 different areas below and above the slump. Borough sewer and water employees hope the samples will shed light on how viscous the ground material in the moving area is within the next few weeks.
They know that it's material that's not able to hold up the weight of you know, the material above, and then depending on the amount of water that's coming through it and stuff. Some of these clay lenses, for example, can absorb water and get real like jello.
In the meantime, a warm weather front moving into Haines has site crews even more alert. Above freezing temperatures and close to 4 inches of rain predicted for that exact area by the end of the week has convinced the borough to take further precautions.
It's very concerning because with those large cracks that we're not able to even see, let alone get to fill with materials, any increase of water flowing down there will run off into those cracks and just cause the problem to get more water down there into those unstable soils, which is not a good condition. So it's not good.
Borough representatives have personally alerted residents at 5 houses around the affected area of the activity and are monitoring the area closely. In Haines, I'm Tara Bicknell.
NSTAR, the natural gas utility in the Cook Inlet area, is being sold to a Canadian corporation. NSTAR belongs to Semco Energy, which in turn was owned by Continental Energy Systems in Michigan. The company that is buying Semco is AltaGas of Calgary, which already owns other natural gas distribution systems in the north and a hydroelectric project on the Issyk River in British Columbia. It's paying $1.135 billion for a U.S. presence. NSTAR spokesman John Sim says customers should see no change.
It's important to understand, or for customers to understand, that this will have no immediate impact on base rates. There won't be an adjustment in rates until 2014, which is when our next scheduled rate case is. So, from that perspective, customers, again, it should be seamless.
Sims also says NSTAR's president and management team have been retained, and its largely unionized staff's contracts will be honored by AltaGas. The transaction is expected to be closed in the third quarter of this year. A Fairbanks utility and the state have come to resolution in a long-running rate dispute that will result in customer refunds. The settlement between the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and Fairbanks Sewer and Water will see about 8,500 past and present customers of Golden Heart and College Utilities repaid nearly $4.5 million as a result of rates the commission has determined were too high. The utility's Director of Administration, Tiffany Van Horn, says the settlement covers 2004 through 2006.
how it will work is current customers will receive a credit on their bill. Past customers will be issued a check, and we'll be doing that within 90 days.
Van Horn says there's no estimate on how much the average customer will get. She says some of the revenue from the affected years was set aside in an escrow account while the RCA considered the rates. She says the refunds will come from that account. The utility has maintained it needs higher rates due to increased operating costs, infrastructure replacement, and lower water usage by customers. Meanwhile, the RCA is considering a 2010 rate hike. A decision on those rates is scheduled for September. An effort to uncover new information about an old murder in Fairbanks is gaining momentum. Blogging and social networking are being employed in an attempt to exonerate four local men imprisoned for the 1997 killing of a Fairbanks teenager. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
15-year-old John Hartman was found beaten on a downtown Fairbanks street in the early hours of October 11, 1997. He later died of his injuries, and four other young men were convicted of his murder. George Fries, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent were sentenced to decades in prison. The case, which hinged on circumstantial evidence, alcohol-affected memories, and two recanted confessions derived from since-discredited interrogation techniques, has long generated questions about whether justice was served.
I think enough time has gone by that people are beginning to be willing to say, you know, wait a minute, something always did seem wrong with this.
That's April Monroe Frick. The local real estate agent knew the men who've come to be labeled the Fairbanks Four.
So we grew up with the story, I think, and we grew up with the knowledge that there were a lot of people out there that knew these guys didn't do it. We watched the treatment. We grew up in the climate, you know, the highly racist climate that this happened in. The racial divide was capitalized on, and this became a story of four, you know, wild, savage Native kids who had just brutally killed a child for no reason whatsoever.
Monroe Frick says she decided to take action after reading a story about the 14-year anniversary of the case. She started a website, Free the Fairbanks 4, a Facebook page, online blog, and petition, all aimed at finding the truth.
There are a lot of people that have small pieces of information about this case.
Monroe Frick is a former student of University of Alaska Fairbanks journalism professor Brian O'Donohue. O'Donohue has done extensive research and reporting on the Hartman case. He says the current online dialogue is the latest symptom of a case that troubles many people.
And that's because the more they think about it and the more they talk to other people who were there and around that night, and the more they sort of match recollections, the more they realize that there is reason to doubt the outcome.
O'Donohue and his students have done dozens of interviews with people related to the Hartman murder case. In a 2008 newspaper series on the case, O'Donohue and his students quote local lawmen standing by the convictions handed down by three juries. Current District Attorney Mike Gray and Hartman case prosecutor Jeff O'Brien did not reply to requests for comment. O'Donohue says nothing that's come to light in the years since the trials has supported the state's case.
If the police case is right, something like 50 people who had interactions with the people convicted in this crime would have had to all get together and sort of orchestrate their recollections. That just doesn't seem credible to me.
O'Donohue says failed appeals on behalf of the men have focused narrowly on individual police and court procedures. He says a broader sea of information points to their innocence, but it will take a bombshell revelation to leverage exoneration.
There won't be a resolution of this case that has traction in the courts until someone comes forward that has direct knowledge that folks were involved that are not serving time right now, that the Fairbanks Four, as this blog refers to them, are innocent because someone else did the crime. And that's the sort of thing that perhaps this community blogging effort might elicit.
The web activity is growing off other recent efforts in the Hartman case. The Tanana Chiefs Conference started a reward for new information that's grown to over $10,000. The Alaska Innocence Project, an Anchorage-based nonprofit legal organization that takes up wrongful convictions, has been working the case for the last few years. Executive Director Bill Oberle says people have been coming forward with tips and leads.
We're getting information that may be leading us to individuals we think may have been the actual perpetrators. And I would expect that at some point we're going to put those names forward.
Oberle, a 30-year criminal defense attorney, says it's a race against time as memories fade and people who may know something die. The ultimate goal of the effort is to put together information to leverage a declaration of innocence or a new trial for the four men now in their 30s serving long sentences at jails in Alaska and Colorado. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The City of Anchorage has received a $13.2 million allocation from the Department of Commerce. The money is meant to help people start small businesses. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Lucinda Mahoney, Chief Financial Officer for the Municipality of Anchorage, announced the award at Tuesday's Assembly meeting and explained how the program will work.
It will provide seed capital for startup businesses and for angel investments in the City of Anchorage. It's really exciting because it's probably one of the first times that we've received a grant of this magnitude that will really help us spur economic development for our community and create jobs.
The money comes to Anchorage via the Small Business Jobs Act of 2010, which President Obama signed into law in September of that year. Anchorage is the first and only city to be awarded the funding, which is typically awarded to states. About $450,000 of the funds will go toward overhead, and the rest will be distributed to startups and existing small businesses with under 500 employees over the next 2 years. The first deadline for grant applications will be this summer. I'm Daisha Eaton.
Chickaloon author Eowyn Ivey has hit the jackpot with her first novel, The Snow Child. Her story about two homesteading Alaskans almost a century ago is capturing the attention of readers from Norway to Australia. The title was released in the U.S. this week to glowing reviews by writers and critics. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer spoke with the author at Fireside Books in Palmer, where she was signing copies of the novel.
Eowyn Ivey seems to be making the transition from Matanuska Valley wife and mother of two to the focus of international literary attention with as little fuss as possible. At Fireside Books, she's signing copies of The Snow Child for buyers, then packing them up herself in cardboard cartons for shipment to book lovers out of state. Husband Sam helps by hauling the book-heavy cartons out to the car, braving Palmer's fierce winds and a blustering of snow. Local fans bring their copies to be autographed, too. They all know her, or at least of her. Eowyn Ivey grew up in Alaska. She credits her mother with encouraging her to write.
It was a part of how I was raised. She's a big fan of books. She's a poet, actually, and writes poetry. And so literature was always very much a part of my life growing up.
Her unusual name, from a character in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, may have marked her as a writer, literally from birth.
And people never used to recognize it until the movies came out.
After college, Ivy did a 10-year stint on the Frontiersman newspaper. She says reporting helped shape her writer's discipline, but didn't leave time for personal craft. It was when she started working part-time at the bookstore that the creative muse came calling.
It was the strangest experience because it was instantaneous. Right when I saw the little kid's book, and it was just a real short children's book, so I read it standing there as I was getting ready to shelve it, and I knew right then that this was the storyline I had been looking for, because I'd always, I'm going to write about Alaska, it's the place I know and I love, but I'd always wanted to write something that had a little bit of magic to it, but I hadn't found the path into that. So right when I saw it, I knew I had the plot line. I didn't know how it would all unfold, who the characters would be, but I knew it was going to work.
The Snow Child is based on an old Russian fable, but it's not a story for children. Ivy's portrayal of a post-middle-aged couple carrying heart-wrenching inner demons and despair through the dead of a 1920s Alaska winter is no fairy tale.
All along, I had all these possible endings, but I didn't know where it was going to go, which was surprising to me. And until the very last chapters, I wasn't positive what was going to happen. And I don't want to give it away, so I won't say that.
But the elusive child of the title sparkles through the couple's lives like sunlight dazzling fresh powder, and Ivy's writing makes the reader hear the crusty croak of the raven, see the muted glow of oil lamp light on log walls, and feel the harsh warmth of a wood stove. Again, she credits family encouragement with honing her skill.
I think I did the best writing when my mom and I came up with a pact where she would give me a poem each week and I would give her a chapter each week. And the idea was we wouldn't overly critique each other. It was just a deadline. And we would read it, tell each other what we liked about it, and then on to the next one. And that was how I wrote The Snow Child over the course of about a year. Just, you know, turning it over quickly, moving on to the next one, and that pace worked well.
Once she decided to tackle the book, Ivy converted a closet into a home office and wrote 2 hours every night. She hadn't completed the novel when she attended Homer's Kachemak Bay Writers Conference and made a fortunate connection with literary scout Jeff Kleinman.
And I didn't have it with me. I didn't have the manuscript with me because I hadn't intended to do that. But eventually my husband got him faxing, emailing all this rigmarole, and the next day he offered to represent it. So that's, to me, is completely contrary to how I thought things would go. And then it was, you know, we worked together, I finished the manuscript. He helped me with some revisions, and then he began sending it out to publishers. And when Little Brown acquired it, instantaneously it was acquired by publishers in Europe and around the world, which was, again, completely contrary to what I expected.
It seemed destined. There was no flurry of rejection slips from publishers. Instead, The Snow Child was released in France, Norway, Sweden, Italy, and England before its American debut. Ivy herself seems to be taking her newfound celebrity in stride.
I feel like I have a very clear sense of how I want my life to be, and I'm very content with my life. And so as much as I want to support the book and I'll do some traveling, I want to retain the lifestyle I've had these last years.
Io and Ivy's first novel may presage many more to come. She's already gathering background for her next work. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Angela Denning Barnes and Mark Earhart in Bethel, Tara Bicknell in Haines, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Ellen Lockyer in Palmer, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Josh Edge from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state governments since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of adding stability and security to our economy by settling Alaska families into homes across the state. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.